Accession number 13856, reel 1.
Commander here, reel 1. You were telling me that you were born in Perth.
That is right.
Which year was that?
1916, October.
How did you come to be in the Fleet Air Arm?
The reason is, goes back a bit early. I got a flight in a Bristol sort of aircraft when I was still at school, which I thought was marvellous. And when I got to that critical age where one has to make up one's mind about a career, of course this was in 1934-35, I really wanted to join the Navy. That was my prime endeavour. But by the time I was clever enough to pass the civil service entrance exam from a public school into the Navy, I was too old. I was overage for being accepted. So I then elected to join the Royal Marines because, like the Air Force, they had a more flexible or a higher age limit. Much to my surprise, I passed in 9th out of 13, and there were 200 applicants that year. So I felt rather pleased about that. But being in the Royal Marines was quite a different kettle of fish. I had told the interview board that I only wanted to do. Did I join the Royal Marines, they said. I said, because at least they go to sea, which was the prime thing I wanted to do. Well, when I did eventually complete all my courses, which are sub-lieutenant's courses, you know, the ordinary naval officers do, I then was posted to HMS Devonshire and the 1st Cruiser Squadron based in Malta. A year of that, which included one or two rather exciting events, the most extraordinary one was the Spanish non-intervention patrol, which we did, and I still got a picture of, at least, of the Admirante Severis, or signed by the captain and all the officers, when on a visit to that ship in Parma, I was qualified as a Cardinal Puff in Spanish, which I thought was rather an achievement, if you know what I mean. Cardinal Puff being a slightly amusing drinking game. But when I returned to the ship, when I had to go on watch, I was definitely the worse for wear. Is this at all of the right sort of stuff?
Yes. What units were you serving in during the Spanish Civil War?
In HMS Devonshire. A county-class cruiser, 3 funnels, 30 knots, as they said.
And what kind of plane were you flying?
Oh, I wasn't flying. I was still a Royal Marine, just playing with guns and things. And I'm only saying all this was the amusing part of having this commission in Devonshire, because I was put under close arrest at that stage for being incapable of being on duty, which is not quite true, but nevertheless. So I had to, when I was arraigned in front of the captain, said, have you got anything to say? And I said, yes, I have, sir, because I've invited the wardroom of the Admirante Severis to come on board tomorrow, Sunday, for forenoon drinks, which rather put a different complexion on the whole business. So I was told to wait outside, and so I was released from a close arrest and given a wigging and told to get on with it. So it was very droll the next morning, having been through this trauma on board, to be right in front introducing the Spanish officers to my captain and commander. However, I realized then that being a Royal Marine at sea was not the most exacting of life. And as I had seen a lot of flying at Califrana, how far down there, and got friendly with people and officers in the Glorious, which was also in the Mediterranean at that time, I decided I had better join the Fleet Air Arm. That's because then I would have got out of the Marines. So in 1938, at the end of 38, I traveled back to London and England, and the beginning of 39, I did my flying training course at Rochester with a lovely chap, Flight Attendant Garnons Williams. I don't know what happened to him. But we were trained on Avro Tutors, about the loveliest aeroplane you could ever want to fly. And that was Rochester. And from there I graduated to Netheravon, number one flying training school, and we were the first course to go through training on Harvards. In those days, the Harvard was not such a reliable plane as it became later on, and we killed about a third of the course. There was about 40 of us, and I think about 15, 10 or 12 of us, 12 of our course were killed, either night flying or landing accidents or mid-air collisions and things like that.
Was it some specific fault or a variety of things?
Oh, no. It was mostly because the airplane, in certain conditions, was relatively unstable. They used to drop a wing. They tried all sorts of modifications to the Harvard. Now, of course, it is almost foolproof. And there's still a Harvard flying around here, which brings back old memories. So after that, is this the right lines we're on?
Please, yeah.
The war then began in 1939. Of course, there was great problems milking the tankers, the bowsers, as some of us used to do, although I must admit I never actually milked a bowser full of rather high-octane fuel to produce our cars, petrol for the cars. One or two people got caught, but not me. That was Netheravon. And from there,
what was your reaction to the news of the outbreak of war? Were you dismayed about it?
Yes, I was very sad. But of course, I reckoned it was inevitable. In fact, I always say that another of the reasons of wanting to opt out of marine labors and get back into the Navy was that the stories I'd heard about the First World War and the trenches was so... we've already discussed that in the car, but it was borne very visibly on me that anything rather than be cannon fodder in the trenches and anything to do with military life was then slightly abhorrent. And, of course, I said, well, people asked me why I wanted to avoid the Army. I said, well, the Navy, at least in the wardroom, you've got four good meals, four good courses at dinner, and three regular meals, and a good wine cellar, and hot baths available day and night, and all the comforts you can think of. So what a much better way to fight the war. That's one of the reasons I went from the Marines, or got seconded, because I remained as a Marine in Marine uniform, but I was seconded to the Fleet Air Arm.
What was your first operational squadron?
Now, wait a minute. I can't... Yes, I'll tell you that in a minute. But we went to... At the completion of our training in fighters, we were sent overland by train. Have you heard about this one? To do our deck landing training. So in December 1939, we were all sent across to France, catch the blue train to Marseille, down to here, where the Argus was operating out of Toulon. And there we had to do fly skuas, rocks, and gladiators and things, and do, I think, about a dozen deck landings each. And when we'd finished that in about the middle of January, we came back via Paris, and we stopped off. We had about 4 hours in Paris, so I walked down the Champs-Élysées, and there I saw, with a sense of awful shock, an ME-109 outside the Lido on the pavement there. So we stopped and had a gloat at it, and thinking of this awful instrument that Hitler had produced that we may have to fight. That was in January 1940, and the sort of a phony war was still on. So it was after that I got back to England. I was posted to 806 Squadron, but then the Norwegian war started, and I was immediately switched to reinforce 801 Squadron, which at that time only consisted of six skuas. Skuas are all rocks. And they were based in Ark Royal. So that my first experience of war was flying a skua from the Ark Royal to dive bomb Trondheim. There were supposed to be supply ships and so forth like that in there. All we encountered, of course, was a lot of flak and flaming onions and all these other things that were hurled at us, which wasn't very pleasant. But we all returned from that particular raid. There were about 18 of us, I think. And then we mounted fighter patrols over Namsos, Aldersnes, and all those places, all up and down the coast where the British had their troops ashore. And that's when we ran into the first Heinkel 111, which we demolished. At least, unfortunately, Bill Squires, who was my flight leader, he went in to do an attack, and as he pulled up away, the tail gunner shot his tank up, and he blew up in an awful ball of flame. And that was a horrible shock to see death so instant.
Who shot the Heinkel down?
Well, I suppose I did in the end, but I mean, I wouldn't like to say that it was. I have no doubt that Squires had probably put a few bits of lead in it. But it took about 10 minutes of chasing, sitting on his tail, pumping. We only had four 303 machine guns in the skewer. But finally, he caught fire, or his smoke came out, and he landed in the sea. We carried a rear gunner. They had a Lewis gun. Can you imagine it? First World War Lewis gun in the stern of the skewer. And as I circled around these things and the crew was climbing out into their things, he started to shoot at them on that. I said, look, lay off that lot. Stop firing at the poor bastards, I said. They're going to have a hard enough time. There was ice floating in the water. They were at least 4 miles away from anywhere else. I think they'd had a hard time to get where they get back. I said, it might have been us.
Shooting at the men in the water?
There were the Germans getting out into their dinghies. So we got
this
back.
This was at Namsos, did you say?
Well, it was that area. We made a landfall. We were about 80-100 miles out to sea, so we had to fly in to get to a headland and then patrol about 30 to 50 miles down the coastline towards Namsos. The maps we were using, they had no maps. You'd have thought the tourists that had been to Norway would have got better road maps, would have shown roughly where the fjords were and the roads were and the hills and so on. But all we got was reproductions of Admiralty charts, which of course showed the soundings and the fjords all right, but very little detail otherwise. So as for map reading from the air, it wasn't very helpful. I don't know, this goes on for hours, I'm afraid.
That's all right.
But that was the first time. Then the next time was when I was flying a rock as air defense of the fleet, if you please. Well, we had no radio communication. So So we used to have orders to patrol the fleet and shoot down any shadowers, you see. So we'd sit about 8,000 feet somewhere over the fleet. Well, the first time I did that, I saw JU-88 crawling around about 20 miles from the fleet. So with my enormous height advantage, I reckon I could catch him up, but I was in a rock, you see. So having dived down almost vertically on this JU-88, when I got within about a quarter of a mile, he saw me, and I could see by the puff of smoke from his engines, he'd spotted me and was putting the power on, and he shot off. And of course, I then screamed down. But if I had a rock which had a turret at the back, so the only way to get the turret to bear was to invert the aircraft while almost vertical. And I shouted to my gun, I said, "When do you see him fire?" So I got upside down and looking at this JU-88. And my rear gunner pulled the trigger, and there was one bang, and that was all. There was a stoppage in all the guns. What a waste of time. I was pretty angry about them, that Boulton and Paul, the turret they put in. So that was a bit of a... Anyway, we drove the shadow away, if that means anything. Incidentally, about air defense, it was so elementary. What was no radio control? We had no radar either. And our instructions were just to patrol the fleet overhead. Well, I went up in a skua this time, and I'd been up for about 3 hours, and I thought that I was getting a bit low on petrol, so after I'd been up 3 hours, I came back to the Ark and circled round her. She was steaming crosswind somewhere. And so I flashed my identity signal and flew up alongside, and there's a lot of faces staring at me, and finally the ship turned into wind, and I landed on. When I got to flying control, they said, "We thought we'd lost you. Where have you been?" I said, "I've been your air defense for the last 3 hours." They had no idea I was up there. It was marvelous, wasn't it?
Can I take you back to the attack on Trondheim?
Yeah.
Can you tell me more about what you remember about that?
Well, there's very little to be said. There were about 18 of us. There was 800 squadron, led by, I think, Smeaton or Partridge. And our lot, I think, Bramwell. Peter Hugh Bramwell was the CO. And I was just a sprog in one of the flights. All we got was anti-aircraft fire. We were armed with a 500-pound bomb, and on the wings we had about two or three of Cooper bombs. Do you know about Cooper bombs?
No.
They were 20-pound. They were 20-pound fragmentation bombs. Pretty nasty things, actually. But they had no fuses on them, so that the moment you dropped them, they were alive. And when they hit anything, so they blew up. So we just dived down on the wharfs and jetties and things and dropped our egg. After all, 500-pound bomb isn't a very important matter when you think of 12,000 pounds as one of the big blockbusters. So I don't think we achieved anything very much. In any case, having met with his anti-aircraft fire, we were all pretty keen to get out of the danger area without being shot down. And we scuttled across. I remember screaming across the inland waters, a sort of inland fjord it was, a bay, and I spotted a merchant ship at anchor, so I dropped my Cooper bombs on top of that thing. But we've no idea whether they had any effect at all. I don't suppose they did. It was pretty abortive, because we really didn't have a sufficiently adequate target. Anyway, there were far better strikes than that one. They had sunk the cruiser, the Hipper class cruiser in the earlier days from this dive bombing. But all the rest of my stuff was on fighter patrols, either inland, going inland, or over the fleet. It was all very difficult. The visibility and the weather was not very good either. So setting off from a headland in Norway to find your carrier 80 to 100 miles out at sea on a compass course, where you stuck religiously to the course, and then you had a radio beacon which you could pick up. But of course it never worked. So I remember coming back and wondering in this awful clag what would I do if I got to the time when I should see the carrier and then go around doing a square search looking for it, by which time I'd run out of fuel, nobody'd know I was there, no communication. It was a hazard which put a lot of stress into us. But fortunately, I looked down through a gap in the clouds, and there the fleet was. Sometimes, you see, in those days, operational emergencies would cause the admiral or captain not to be in his stated position. Before you took off, you were given a position where the carrier would be when you returned. Well, of course, if other events happened, like popping up of pocket battleships and so forth, it might not be there. And you'd no idea whether the ship was still there or not, in which case you just had to land in the water and goodbye to all that. That was the unpleasantness about that type of flying.
You've got a note here, May 1940, the Rock-On floats fast.
Oh, yes. The Rock-On floats part two, yes. Second attempt. Yes, the Rock-On floats. The great powers that be wanted to have air defense over our troops ashore in Norway. They couldn't find any airfields of any use nearby. The frozen lakes weren't all that hot. The Germans were using them anyway. So they dreamt up a scheme of putting the Rock-On floats, which could then take off from the fields when a raid came in. Well, they had to train a few pilots up, and so they grabbed hold of me and sent me back to England, down to Leon Solent, to practice flying a Rock-On floats. In order to train me up to that standard, they got a swordfish, and swordfish on floats are quite easy to fly in their normal way. You open up the throttle and off she goes, no problem. To simulate what it's like flying a Rock-On floats, which is a very underpowered sort of heavy monoplane, one, instead of taking off with plus 4 pounds boost, you had to set the throttle about the third of the way open, and you had minus 2 pounds of boost. Well, then they said you need at least 2 miles in a swordfish to take off with such low power, so make certain that the way is open on the sea. And when you get to about 60 knots, they said, start stirring the pudding, which is rotating the joystick, hoping that that will make the plane lurch from one wave top to another. And with any luck, after about a mile and a half, she might just get thrown into the air. And once the drag of the water is gone, and then she'll fly around, rather in a clumsy way anyhow. So that was, with some fear and apprehension, I approached this business. And I'm very glad to say that the whole scheme was abandoned shortly afterwards. And I inquired why, and they told me that all the pilots that had actually tried to fly the Rock on floats, and I think there were three, had all killed themselves in the endeavor, and they couldn't stand the wastage anymore. So we were very much relieved. I think we've dealt with the navigation and the charts, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
In the past.
Right. The squadron moved to Detling for Dunkirk. Can you tell me about that, please?
Oh, yes. Well, after that, 801 flew off from the Ark and went down to Detling. Detling was a coastal command station in Kent, and handy for the beaches in Dunkirk. and our job was to provide air defense of convoys, also to do fighter patrols over the beaches of Dunkirk. And then, of course, we come to the dive bombing side. Do you want the story of Churchill and co? Well, I've no real grounds for saying it is positive fact, because I wasn't at the meeting. But this was a story that went around at the time, that Churchill was furious that the British Army were defeated by the Ju-87, the German dive bomber, and had rolled up the British Army with such apparent ease. So he said, well, where are our dive bombers? Why haven't we got any dive bombers? And the RAF sort of hadn't got any, so they kept quiet. And then some silly fool dressed in naval uniform said, excuse me, sir, I think we have some dive bombers. So he said, well, let them be, let them get on with his dive bombing and win the war for us. And so the edict went forth that any dive bomber that had been, was to get cracking on dive bombing the Germans. But we didn't think that was a very good idea, being in our squadron. So the RAF then had to dream, because we were working under coastal command, the RAF had to dream up some way of getting us dive bombing in France. And because they insisted that the Navy should only dive bomb naval targets or targets at sea, they insisted that they found, anyway, there was a pontoon bridge over the canal at Newport, just east of Dunkirk, and insisted that that was a suitable target for the Navy to deal with, rather than dive bombing a tank division in the field. And it was just about the end of May or early June that we set off, all nine of us, with a 500-pound bomb. We waited until 6 in the evening before we took off, because the Air Force said they'd have 36 Spitfires in the sky to give us protective cover. So off we went. We got to Newport without much any opposition at all. There was the canal. We couldn't see any pontoon bridge, but nevertheless, Bramwell signaled us to dive bomb the canal. I suppose there was a bit of permanent roadway over it. So we all had a go at that. Heaven knows whether we hit it or not. Dropped our bombs, and when we recovered at low level and were climbing back away to go back to England, we thought we saw our fighter escort. But when they got closer, they'd all got iron crosses on their wings, and that's when we ran into about a dozen 109s. I had the misfortune to have one of them tie himself to me, and I got chased halfway across the channel by this 109, and we managed to survive. But four out of the nine of us were shot down.
Can you tell me the story of how you managed to shake him off?
Yes, well, I have described it in that book, So Few. The camouflage of the naval aircraft was pretty good. They had sort of greeny, black, dark, and blue camouflage, which made them hard to spot if you were on the water and you're looking down at the water. And we also had a very tight turning circle. At least we could, because we were going so slowly. I was, at that time, in trying to keep up a speed of not less than 150.